This is Nachyomi, Sefer Shemo El Bet, chapter 19. David's response to the news of Avshalom's death is heart-wrenching. It's probably one of the most emotional, if not the most emotional, scene in the entire Tanakh. He's totally consumed by his grief. His supporters become aware of the fact that he's in mourning, and the people feel very uncomfortable. They don't know how to approach him. Yoav confronts David and rebukes him harshly for his reaction. Yoav reminds David that had they not been victorious on the battlefield, all of them, including David's entire family, would have been killed. By reacting to the outcome of the war as if it were a tragedy, David is essentially implying that he would rather his friends and associates and family be dead than his rebellious son. This, Yoav argues, will lead to David's abandonment, even by those who are closest to him. David agrees with Yoav's assessment, composes himself, and seats himself at the gate to receive the people. The tribes of Israel reflect upon the aftermath of the conflict and decide that the time has come to restore David officially to his position of leadership. However, David himself reaches out to the elders of his own tribe of Yehuda and subtly criticizes them for not being the first to offer to escort him back to the palace. He removes Yoav as general of his army and replaces him with Amasa, Avshalom's general, who also hailed from the tribe of Yehuda. In both cases, David himself makes reference to the natural familial affiliation he has with these individuals or parties. On his way back to Yerushalayim, David is first intercepted by Shim'i ben Gera, who has come to apologize for his unseemly conduct in cursing and throwing stones and dust at David. He comes to beg for forgiveness. Shim'i has arrived in the company of 1,000 men of the tribe of Binyamin, including Tziva, the servant of Mephibosheth, and his 15 sons and 20 servants. Avishai ben Tzruya suggests that they kill Shim'i for having disgraced and cursed the anointed one, the anointed king. David, however, orders him to desist and promises Shim'i that he will not be killed. Mephibosheth is the next person to welcome David back to Yerushalayim. He has evidently been in a state of mourning. He's unshaven and disheveled with clothes that haven't been washed. David asks Mephibosheth why he chose not to accompany him into exile. Mephibosheth explains that he indeed wished to come, but that his servant Tziva fooled him. Rather than preparing a donkey for Mephibosheth to ride upon, Tziva absconded with the donkey and provisions himself, and then slandered his master to the king. Mephibosheth emphasizes that he owes an eternal debt of gratitude to David for having spared him and his family, and that he will willingly accept whatever judgments David decrees. David responds to Mephibosheth's lengthy speech somewhat curtly and harshly, seems impatient almost. He chides him for elaborating so much, and he declares that the state of Sha'ul should be divided evenly between Mephibosheth and Tziva. Mephibosheth declines the offer and expresses his wish that all of the property go to Tziva, since the knowledge that David has been restored to the monarchy is sufficient for him, and he has no need for these material goods. David next addresses Barzillai Giladi, who helped him while he was on the run, and encourages him to come and live in Yerushalayim. Barzillai responds that he's too old and his senses are too dull to benefit from retirement in Yerushalayim. His taste buds have lost their capacity to enjoy food and his ears can no longer enjoy music. Barzillai prefers to finish his life in his own city, but sends his son, Kimham, to live with David and receive whatever rewards David wished to bestow upon him. The chapter concludes with a description of tensions that have erupted between the tribe of Yehuda and the other tribes of Israel. The majority are upset that the tribe of Yehuda has played such a significant role in accompanying the king back to the palace, especially in view of the fact that the other tribes were the first to take an initiative on this. The tribe of Yehuda points out that it has never been the beneficiary of any special favors or kindnesses from David as a result of his affiliation with them. They only got involved out of a sense of obligation to their relative. The other tribes respond that as the vast majority of the nation, they have 10 shares in David and should have been consulted on and included in this welcome home party. We are told that the words of the tribe of Yehuda were stronger than those of the other tribes. This either means they were stronger in tone, or it means they were more persuasive. David displays an unusual amount of partisanship in this chapter by favoring his own tribe of Yehuda. Until now, he's been very principled in his impartiality. One wonders whether the change we observe here is because of a general lack of trust he now has, and a sense of weariness that he's developed. The fact that the nation supported Avshalom's rebellion made David feel that he could only rely upon his own. Alternatively, from the fact that Avshalom based his camp in Hebron, a bastion of the tribe of Yehuda, David may have intuited that he himself had failed to ingratiate himself with his own base. And so he was attempting to correct the imbalance by ingratiating himself with the tribe of Yehuda, winning them back. It's noteworthy that in their exchange with the other tribes, the representatives of Yehuda make mention of the fact that they have received no benefits or favoritism from David during his rule. This can be interpreted as a praise of David's objectivity and fairness, or as a veiled complaint that they were never granted the privileges that they expected. Whatever the case may be, we will see that tensions among the tribes spell more trouble for David in the near future. David's deposing of Yoav, like his intense mourning for Avshalom, both reveal to us a mentality that is now somewhat typical of the new David, who is more preoccupied with his own fate and personal needs than those of the nation as a whole. Yoav was not fired for killing Avner, for example, even though it was treacherous and unwarranted and condemned by David. Yet here, when he killed Avshalom because of the fact that he was a rebel against the crown, he's dismissed from his position. David may have justified his distinguishing between the two cases by citing the fact that here Yoav actually acted in direct defiance of a direct order, whereas David never explicitly warned Yoav not to harm Avner, so he couldn't fully blame him for that. However, our impression in general is that David is acting emotionally rather than rationally. And we can see this from the fact that he appoints the treasonous and failed general of Avshalom, Amasa, in place of the loyal and accomplished Yoav. The reason given is because Amasa is a member of his family and a relative, but really Yoav was too. Again, David may have defended his decision based upon a desire to reunify and consolidate the kingdom, erasing the divisions that had been created by the rebellion, and showing that there was no ill will lingering between him and those who had allied themselves with Avshalom. In retrospect, however, it's going to become clear that this perspective was a bit naive. David's treatment of Mephibosheth is roundly criticized by the rabbis in his seemingly rash decision to divide the property between Mephibosheth and Tziva when it seems obvious that Tziva was lying and that Mephibosheth is telling the truth. So the punishment was that one day his kingdom would also be split. So on the surface, David's harshness toward the lame and helpless Mephibosheth is puzzling, but if we take it in the context of his general swing of preference in favor of his own tribe and family, we can interpret his behavior as a reflection of some feelings of hostility and mistrust toward the house of Shaul, represented by Mephibosheth. David's earlier graciousness to Mephibosheth was part of his effort to reunite the kingdom and to eliminate or mitigate the divisions that existed between various tribes or factions within the nation. But now his new program, at least temporarily, seems to be a reversion to the old-fashioned way of doing things. And that means favoring his own tribe. He has no patience or sympathy for Mephibosheth at the moment. This exacerbation of the divisions between the tribes, particularly the singling out of the tribe of Yehuda for special treatment, and the sense of us against them, may have laid the groundwork, as the sages suggest, for future division in the nation, the bifurcation of the Jewish people into the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Israel. It has also been suggested that David was prejudiced against Mephibosheth for historical reasons. Yonatan, Mephibosheth's father, also made the fateful and tragic decision not to follow David into exile, but to remain at the palace by his father Shaul's side. He did this, neglecting to join David and part ways with Shaul, even though he professed a belief that David was destined to be king and that his father was wrong. It's possible that David interpreted Mephibosheth's actions as a replay of this betrayal by Yonatan that he could never fully forgive. Barzillai Giladi is also worthy of a few comments. The sages remark that he was steeped in instinctual pleasures, and this is why his senses were dull. Although he was clearly a kind, generous, and loyal friend to David, the rabbis disparage his moral character. What is their basis for this assessment? I'd like to suggest that the reasons he offers for declining to join David in Yerushalayim reveal his value system. If he is not able to partake of fine food and wine and listen to beautiful music, he sees no benefit in residing in the holy city of Yerushalayim. In other words, his definition of what is worthwhile or meaningful in life is totally materialistic and sensual. A deeper, more spiritual person would yearn to be in Yerushalayim for the right reasons, for the opportunities to learn Torah, to serve Hashem, to be inspired. Such an individual would be focused on the quality, of the cuisine or the musical offerings available to him in the palace. By contrast, Barzillai, who turns down the chance to live in Yerushalayim because his age prevents him from enjoying the high life, or the good life, so to speak, demonstrates clearly the values and priorities that guide him. He shows us what he thinks makes life worth living, namely, not the inspiration of the soul, but the pleasures of the body.